Mr. Gaynor was born in Florida, but was raised in the ghetto of Newark, New Jersey, a district he describes as a slum worse than Harlem. From here he left, the age of 16, trying many vocations along the way in an attempt to rid his bosom of some of the creativity he felt was locked there. His friends in the village of New York, where he was trying his hand at photography, introduced him to the film, to the field of filmmaking, a field in which he's been extremely successful. Mr. Gaynor is currently producer at WGBH-TV in Boston. He was the associate producer for CBS-TV's Of Black America series. He has been involved as cameraman, editor, director, and/or producer for films, national education television productions, and more than 750 television commercials. At present, Mr. Gaynor is planning to go to Mississippi to work for a division of the Poor People's Campaign, training black students in the field of filmmaking. And in August, he is off to Africa to shoot a film. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Wardell Gaynor.
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, I brought this film to you here because it has particular meaning for me. When I was photographing it, I spent a year in the jungles of Harlem, and it brought back my childhood to me. I spent 25 years in the jungles of America, the ghettos of America, fighting the system. Before I discovered film, producing this film made me realize how fortunate I was to escape from that jungle. I spent 25 years fighting a different system, trying to get into the television and film field, trying to prove myself on different grounds. And all of a sudden, I discovered how popular I am because I'm black. This is the year to be beautiful if you're black. But it doesn't really matter to me about the popularity because I've stopped trying to prove myself to anybody because I know what I am. I know I'm good. I know that white society knows I'm good or they wouldn't be using me. So that doesn't disturb me any longer. I've spent the last several years now, because of the popularity of black things, and doing most of my work in black fields. It was very rewarding for me to be with the CBS series, not because of CBS, because they knew I was around all the while. But because I had an opportunity to work among my people again. And what it has done for me is to give me a great desire to help as much as possible the dreams of some of the black people in communities that have not the access to the things that I have been fortunate enough to have access to. Miss Brown said I left home when I was 16. It was really 13. And the experiences that I found in those first 25 years, I think, helped me to go through this film career that I have been so involved with. There is, I think, in America today, a beautiful thing happening. Black people are no longer ashamed of being black. They're no longer afraid to be black. But this was not always the case. For many years, we tried to emulate in everything we did white people in order to work on the grounds that they had prepared for us, in order to succeed in the image that they had set forth for us. I don't think that white people really understand black people. I'm sure of that. The most desperately needed commodity in America today is communication, understanding, an interchange of information between blacks and whites. We're living in a racist society. We have been since the founding of America. Black people have always known this because they've had to cope with it. White people, I think, refuse to recognize the depth of their ignorance of black people and what they are all about. They go stumbling along in their gratuitously benevolent fashion, bestowing their largesse to black people and expecting in return, oh, I don't know really what they expect, but when they get rebelled against, they wonder, what is it that black people want? What do they want from us? I'll tell you what black people want. They want liberation. They want liberation. Black people are tired of carrying the white people on their shoulders. They're tired of trying to educate the white people in the basic concepts of what sensitivities to one's fellow man really means, what brotherhood really means, what humanity really means. White people sometimes deal with things black in a very surface manner. I was called into one of the biggest advertising agencies in the country, if not the world, just recently, to discuss a film for the Urban League. I went to the agency, big proposing building on Park Avenue, New York City, took the elevator up to one of their five floors that they occupied, introduced myself to the receptionist, and waited for the man I was to see. He came out, stylishly dressed, which I have nothing against because I dress stylishly myself, I think. His hair was a little short, blonde curls. He was white. I didn't mind that either because my hair's kind of curly too. He stuck his hand out at me. He says, hey, man, like it's good to see you. I'd been around a long time. He brought me into his office, which was nicely proportioned, not ostentatious, good taste. He had windows which showed he was pretty high in the agency. And he started to talk to me how difficult it was to find a black producer. And he couldn't understand why it was difficult to find a black producer, because like there was lots of work out there. I could have told him how difficult it was and why it was difficult to find a black producer, but I didn't bother. I thought he should know. He really should know. He went on talking about the film that he had planned to do, and he took his jacket off, and he said, take your jacket off, man, if you like, because, you know, like, around here, we're pretty informal, and want you to feel at ease. Well, I've learned through experience that it's best, if you want to leave with dignity sometimes, to keep your clothes together. Because sometimes you can get pretty uptight talking to these people in these agencies. So I kept my jacket on. He went on to describe the type of picture that he wanted to make. And went something like this. He said, I want to deal with this picture very simply. Very simply. I don't want to have anything that's elaborate. I want to deal with this because it's so very important to me. I want to show, open my picture with an empty screen and then pan the camera down and then show this black face lined with dignity. This man, this old man, with all the cares in his face. And then I want his eyes to open slowly, and his eyes open slowly, I want to dissolve to a beautiful black woman with a hair and a full afro. And she turns slowly to her right, and then I want to slow dissolve to a black child. And I want all of it to be beautiful and soft and with great meaning, because that's where it really is. He said, "Do you dig?" I said, "I think what you're trying to say is you'd like to have a picture that shows that black people are beautiful." He said, "Yeah, that's what I'd like." I said, "Well, are you going to have voiceover? Are you going to have sync sound? Or what are you going to have, music?" He said, "Yes, I'm going to have music." He said, "What we'll do is, I got this great idea. I'm going to take Otis Redding and have him sing one of James Brown's songs. And then I'll have him sing a couple of his own tunes, you know, and let him spread this out through the length of the picture." I looked at him. I said, "That might be kind of difficult to get Otis." He said, "No, man, money's no object. Money's no object." I said, "We'll make it." I said, "Well, maybe I better tell you that Otis Redding has been dead for quite a while. His face dropped, his mouth popped open." He said, "Well, we'll get somebody that sings like him." Well, I didn't hear the rest of his conversation for the next 10 minutes. I sat there, but I was thinking how important that picture was to him. All of the money at the disposal of the agency, which I will remain nameless, that he hadn't found out that the man that he wanted to use as a very important part of his picture was no longer with us. And it sometimes is typical of the attitudes that white people affect towards black people. They take for granted so much communication, concern, information is a thing that we need a lot of. White people have brought to a fine science the principles of power and how to effectively manipulate power, and how to deal from positions of power. And now black people are beginning to use these same principles to their own means. The development of an acute awareness of what the power ploy is all about, I think, is one of the primary requisites in the black man's education. I know it has carried me a long ways. I learned about manipulation when I was in the jungles. I learned how to read what a man was saying and what he was saying behind what he was saying. And in my dealings with the agencies and with the clients that I had to deal with over the years, it saved me an awful lot of heartaches, made me an awful lot of money. It is an absolute necessity for the black artist to be a political activist today. The black intellectual who tries to function effectively and remain aloof from the struggle, remain aloof from involvement in this society, which is a structure based on a slave system, attempts to attain a position that is untenable and inevitably destructive to his creativity, if not to his psyche. No matter how successful he may become, no matter how successful he will, it will always be meaningless. It will always be sterile until his black brothers are free. And until that moment comes, there is no need for him to seek success because it doesn't exist. When that freedom does come, he will attain everything that he is looking for. And at that moment, too, for the first time, white people will have freedom. Because, be no mistake about it, white people are bound. They are bound, inextricably bound to black people. And if black people go under, white people cannot escape unscathed. And this world today There is going to have to be more communication if it is not already too late. White people are going to have to pay attention and listen and learn to what black people are saying, because black people are turning off now. They don't care any longer whether white people are listening to them or not. And if white people find themselves in a predicament where they can't understand what black people are saying, it's really sad, but that's the way it is. A black man growing up in America today, it is difficult, if not impossible, to develop an accurate assessment of his own intellectual endowment or a knowledge of his spiritual perception. Black people have for years been turning away from things that are black, but now they have recognized that black things are beautiful. They're hacking away at the layers of crud that have been piled on for years and years and years, trying to get along with white people. And now they begin to groove in their own lifestyle, a black lifestyle, black experiences, black emotional responses. They have abandoned the senseless struggle of seeking things white. I'm now involved with a group called the National Black Theater Workshop that is founded by wonderful woman, Barbara Antier, who I think is an alumnus of the University of Illinois. And we are trying to discover, or rather to give rebirth to a new way of black acting. Because there is no such thing in our theater or film form today. And the things that we are trying to develop are the sensitivities, the involvement, the complete gut instincts that black people have so long had at their fingertips, and white people have been trying to emulate too. This theater, I hope, will be one of the first of its kind, but not the last, certainly. It started very small, and already we have outgrown the classes that we have. We're looking around for more space. Black people, as they hear about it, rush to it. And it is, to me, one of the most important things that has happened in my life, with a possible, I think, discovery. Unless it was the discovery of myself and my own blackness when I got out of that jungle. And I am happy and proud that I am still here and seeing black people proud of themselves and moving forward, developing their power, a black power that is going to take their own place in this world. I say peace to you all. Peace to you all. And thank you.
A conversation with Wardell Gaynor. Today's edition of Open End, a series of discussion programs on topics of current interest, produced by WILL, the radio service of the University of Illinois in Urbana. This afternoon, Mr. Wardell Gaynor, noted television producer who has worked with CBS, NET, WNEW, and WGBH, will be talking with Joseph Tankersley, junior in commerce at the University of Illinois, Elise Piquet, author, and John Schuller, head of painting in the College of Fine Arts at the University of Illinois. Now, a conversation with Wardell Gaynor.
Mr. Gaynor, how old were you when you first became interested in communications?
I was 25 years old, Joe, and I decided that communications was the field I wanted to go into. I decided because dealing in writing, as I had been doing before, I knew that I couldn't make a living, and trying to be an artist was not the thing, because black people weren't making any money in art. Very few white people were making money in art. And I decided to go into film because that seemed to be the best outlet for whatever creativity I had.
Mm-hmm. Were there, could you give me some of the obstacles that were facing you at the time?
Oh, well, 25 years ago, Joe, there were a great many obstacles. There were no black people in the field of television, or very few in the field of television or film, and the union situations were such that it was difficult, almost impossible, to get an application to the unions. And there were no companies, no big companies, that would take you on as an apprentice. It was a period of just knocking on doors and going through the usual routine of trying to find someone who'd take a chance.
I see. What degree of self-discipline did you have to impose upon yourself while you were, trying to make it, so to speak?
That's a very good question. I had to learn how to skip a few meals, for one thing.
Oh, I see.
I continually immersed myself in all kinds of film. I would see a movie on 42nd Street two or three times because it was cheap to go to 42nd Street. I would go to the Museum of Modern Art and watch.
Is this in New York?
This is in New York City, yes. There were several small film, 16-millimeter film groups that I would attend showings, and in this manner I got to get a feeling for film that helped me to go through the period.
Now, Wardell, I don't quite picture this time precisely. I've known you well, and I've known a lot about your capacity for incredibly hard work. And I'm sure that drive, whatever the hell that drive was an extremely important thing in the moment you're describing that sort of sent you off in a certain direction. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your background before that time that led you into this particular position in New York at that particular moment, so that you wanted to wrestle with the idea of film.
John, that goes back quite a number of years and to some very painful times in my life. I have worked in many different fields, and it's not certainly not anything new to black people anywhere, trying to find a way out of the jungle that I was born and raised in. I'd been a dishwasher, a bartender, I'd operated a crane, I'd ran with the street gangs, and continually felt a frustration. That is, I wasn't fulfilled, if you forgive
me. Right,
that.
Yeah, right.
I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I did know that I didn't want to continue in the direction that I was going. It seemed to have no end for me. I read an awful lot, still do when I have the time. And one day, I just decided that I had had enough of the struggle as I then saw it, and was going to make an effort to do something that I could get some pleasure out of.
Yeah, had you spent all of your time in New York at that time, or had you been in other parts of the country?
I traveled all over the world. As a matter of fact, I had traveled when I ran away from home at an early age. I was 13, and I stayed away from home for 4 years. I came back when I was 17, almost 17. And that time I traveled all over the United States. Oh. And had been to Europe on board ship, shipping out, lying about my age and a number of other things.
Yeah, yeah.
But I had visited cities all over and small towns all over this country. Come back to New York because New York was where the action was, it seemed. And that's where it happened, in New York City.
What about the, one more question about just in this area before I go on. What about the camera? When did you start looking through the camera eye?
Oh, not until after I'd made a decision to become a photographer.
Oh,
I'd never owned a camera in my life. Never owned a camera until
really
I decided.
It's a terribly abstract decision in a way.
Well, in a way. I thought at the time that I was really eliminating all of the possibilities, and I
yeah,
threw them down.
Yeah.
I said, well, what can I do? What can I do? And
yes.
I said, well, you know, to be any of the other things I would like to do would take too much time, and the returns were not too sure.
Yes, and yeah.
I decided that, well, photography, everybody wants their picture taken because we all have some ego within us to, you know, to satisfy.
Yeah.
And that's the reason why I picked photography. I felt
I
that I could that I could do it and that I could express myself. I was a little impressed by the photographs of the Depression era.
Yes.
That came out of that WPA theater.
Right.
The WPA project.
Yes.
And I suppose that had something to do with it. I was always, I think, visually orientated to begin with. And that, too, had something to do with it.
Yeah, well, I'm sure you were, having seen your work. I mean, it's a natural eye at work.
What about this jungle that you mentioned? What were the conditions in the jungle, and where was this jungle located?
Which specific jungle?
Yeah, which jungle?
Well, my first jungle was in Newark, New Jersey. It's still a jungle. If you read the papers recently, you can tell it hasn't changed very much. There, I lived in the Third Ward in Newark, and it was the hub, I think, of the illegal activities that were running rampant in our ghetto areas at the time. There was some narcotics. It wasn't as great as it is now. There was bootleg whiskey, and there was prostitution, and there was thievery, and there was anything else that you'd really want to go into. The it was a prime place for police brutality, and also many honest policemen, but there were many police who were on the take. And it was a jungle because you had to claw your way out in order to survive. You had to friendship meant very little, very little. It was a desperate thing. And there was a depression on at the time, too. Well, in my early years, there was a depression on, and we were just coming out of that depression, if you remember, 25 years. That's 25 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was indeed a jungle.
Mm-hmm. Does it remind you of something like Charles Darwin's theory of survival of the fittest, where you know, just the fittest come out on top?
Well, only the strongest survive, if you let me coin a cliche. Yes, it does remind me of that. And the weak people do go under, or they are bent so badly that they are maimed thereafter. I feel that I've been very fortunate in breaking out of it. I look back, when I worked on the narcotic film, I had to go back into it to work with the addicts for the film, and it gave me close contact once again with a lot of the activities that I was very much involved with when I was younger. Mm-hmm. And it brought back many painful memories of how close I came to just not being able to get out of it. And I'm very fortunate. I consider myself very fortunate that I was able to come through it.
Can I ask one other jungle question? I don't want to interrupt here, but with my experience, I've often thought of New York being the jungle, and in particular, we all have our little jungles in New York, and I'm wondering about the Madison Avenue jungle, because you did go into advertising work, right?
Oh,
and there's
there's
a whole arena there. You must have something to say about it, because I'm sure the survival of the fittest helps a little.
I'll tell you something that I feel very strongly, that if I had not gone through that jungle in Newark and in New York, too, because I did do a lot of my things in New York, I would not have been able to survive in the jungle of Madison Avenue, because there again, you learn about power in the jungles of our ghettos. You learn how to employ power. You learn how to understand what is being said underneath the spoken word. And this runs rampant in the Madison Avenue jungles.
Yes.
There is a duplicity of meaning that will sometimes confuse people if they don't understand what's really happening.
Right.
I think my background, it was a beautiful university, but I wouldn't want to go through it again.
right. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
You told me when you were 13 and you went away from home, the very first thing you did was to head back south where your parents had come from. Well, how did going back to see that sort of your origins in a way, how did that affect you, and how has that affected you now?
Hmm. Well, my family, all of my family came from the Deep South, Florida, from my father's family. Were fishing people, and they lived on an island outside of Panama City, Florida, and my mother's family were farming people, and they lived about 20, 30 miles north in Florida. And I had, when I was a child, I had on many Saturday evenings sat around in the background and heard them discuss the things that were very close to them in the South, about the South. And the thought of the South intrigued me because I had no point of reference except through them. And when I decided to run away from home because I felt first of all, closed in Newark, there was very little for outlet for the things that I wanted to do, I decided to go south out of curiosity more than anything else, and I wandered, hitchhiked most of the way to Florida. Many experiences that I won't get into now because they're much too long, but I finally got to Panama City, and I didn't meet any of the people, any of my relatives, because the family that was there still lived on the island, and I didn't have any money to go across the island because the island was a quarter of a mile away and it was a boat to get there. But I did meet some of the South, and in my first experiences with the South, I found them not so totally different from my experiences in the North. That is, you had to be just as careful in the North in a different way. There was more overt action in the South than there was in the North, but it was there. It was there, and I had learned how to expect it and how to deal with it. I visited my mother's birthplace, which was completely different from the seaport area that my father came from, and I felt a great longing for an understanding about the background of my people. At that time, I couldn't put my finger on it, but I really wanted to know what they were all about, where they were from. And every time I ran across some indication of that my family had been... For instance, one of my grand uncles has a street named after him in Panama City. And when I found it, such a feeling of, I don't know whether it was joy or exhilaration ran through me. It was just beautiful ecstasy that here was something I could... pointed, wow, you know, like, this is my uncle, you know, and they named a whole, it was an avenue, actually, they named a whole avenue That's after great. Him, and this was the feeling that I had. I haven't not as yet satisfied that. That is one of my long-range goals, to go back again. I hope to take my father back with me, my father's still living, he's in New Jersey, to take him back with me and to go through that part of the South again and perhaps record some of his feelings about it and get,
Well, this morning at breakfast, we were talking about tradition and how it's changing. And we're all going, hooray.
Yes, yes.
But at the same time, to be able to use a sense of tradition, what you want to take, the good parts of your tradition, and make something creative of this, do you think that trip back in the South, even though it was a while ago, that you draw on this and you use this?
Oh, yes. I tell you the reason why. Not because of my getting to Florida so much, but because of some of the things that happened to me on the way. I met many black people, and now I'm so very much involved with black people in trying to bring together a feeling of greater empathy between our people and to involve black people in growth. I find that many times I think back to the people that I met in the Southland at that time and the feelings that they stirred within me. There was a lonesome thing, there was a missing thing, and I remember once I was in Alabama walking along a country road, and I came along an old farmer who was plowing with an old mule and an older plow. A very old man, or so he seemed to be. Weather-beaten, tanned, dark face, gnarled hands, the whole bit. I stopped and passed the time of day. As a matter of fact, he spoke to me first, and he said, good afternoon, son, and I spoke with him. And to make a long story short, we talked for almost, the better part of an hour. About many things. He asked me about that. He had never been off that farm in his life. Never in all his life. And he must have been at least 60, 65 years old. He asked me about my travels and about the North, about the conditions, about the people, about many, many, many things. And finally, because it was getting late in the afternoon and I was a long ways from a city, I had to leave him. And as I left, he said to me, he said, now, don't you forget to write to me. When you get back, you write me a letter and tell me how you are and how things are. And I said, I sure will. And I left and walked away. About 2 or 3 hours later, I realized I didn't know the man's name, nor his address. But I was so involved with talking with this man that I felt I knew him. He felt that I knew him, as a matter of fact. He'd lived there all his life. He felt, well, everybody knows who I am. He'd never bothered to introduce himself, you know. But it was a weird experience.
You'd say the people down there have more of a neighborly relationship than the people here in the North do?
I wouldn't say that exactly. I would say that black people everywhere relate pretty much the way they are and what creates whatever fears with them. For instance, in Florida, I was walking along the highway again and had to cross, and there was a deep horseshoe curve in the road. And in order to make my journey faster, I crossed an open field that had a little farmhouse, a little shack. It wasn't a farmhouse, really, down in the basin of the valley. And as I got closer, I saw an old black woman who was cleaning some vegetables in the yard. I was pretty thirsty at the time, and I walked over to the fence, and I asked her if I could have a drink of water. And she looked at me, and she ran into the house, and her husband came. I suppose it was her husband came out, and he said, "Yes, what is it? What is it?" And I said, I thought in my nicest, most polite tone, it would be possible to have a glass of water. And he was obviously very frightened. Obviously very frightened. He says, "No, no, no. We can't give you any water. We can't give you..." And I hadn't done anything. I mean, I was just walking over the fields.
Yeah.
But obviously, they were living in some climate of fear.
Fear, yeah.
Yes, yes. Now, this isn't true always. I was in Georgia and walking along a road, and I was picked up by a black man, young black man, who was giving me a ride, who gave me a ride, and we talked for a long while. And then as we got to the city, he said, "Why don't you, if you're going to stay over," he said, "why don't you come and have dinner with my wife and I?" I said, "Fine, you know, this is like great, good Southern cooking and everything, hospitality, the whole thing." I went to his home and I met his wife, young, attractive woman, and she had just prepared supper. Had this sweet smell coming through the kitchen door. It was an old shack with newspaper windows and on stilts. But they were very, very nice young people. And I had visions of this delightful meal that I was going to get. And when it came out, what he had was, she had cooked was some fatback, bacon, and a big hoe cake of corn flour bread and some syrup, and that was supper. Well, I was a little disappointed, but I really didn't want to show it. But they were so beautiful to me. They were so beautiful to me. They'd taken me in and given me what they had. It was a beautiful experience to me.
I have a question in line with this, if I can sort of push ahead quite a number of years. In my own experience in New York, I found certainly the jungle can be a bit frightening at times. At the same time, as I was in it for years, there were all sorts of other people in it too, and many of the warmest and deepest relationships that I've had have been out of my professional experience in New York. And I'm curious as to whether there are particular instances where, even though you were fighting a much tougher battle than I'd be fighting because of the fact that you were probably one of the first black men in this arena that you were in, as to whether, on the other hand, there were certain relationships with whites who were in maybe in somewhat of a parallel situation where you established meaningful communication, meaningful relationships. Are there any? Of course, if there aren't, we can go right on to the next question.
Well, there is balm in Gilead. There was some hope, yes. I can say that I had the opportunity and the beautiful pleasure to have met several white friends who were very dear to me. One of them, who was a director in New York in motion picture and film, Joe Cohn by name, who helped me tremendously in gaining entree to the first big job in the industry that I got. He put himself on the line. And this is what white people really have to do if they have the courage of their convictions. They have to put themselves on the line. Joe didn't back off. He knew that I had been struggling. He had seen my work. He had known me for a while. I had been teaching a class up in Harlem in photography. And he decided that he was going to put himself on the line, and he went downtown, Fifth Avenue, big studio, and said, "This is the man that you need. You need a photographer that has this man's talent." And the owner of the company hemmed and hawed and put his feet up on the table, but he finally came around because Joe just wasn't backing down. Now, that was my first entree into a company, and that entree allowed me to make contacts in the industry and allowed my work to be seen, of course.
Right.
To make contacts in the industry that has lasted me all the rest of these 20-odd years.
Right.
Well, would you have any advice to give to a student aspiring to make a career in communications?
This is a beautiful field to be in. It's a highly lucrative field. I would advise anyone who would like to get into this field, any black student, to prepare himself, though, because it is highly competitive.
How should he prepare himself, though?
The technical schools, I think, would be the best way. Coming through my way would be much too long. The black person today, I don't think he should take 20 years to attain his position. You can go to some of the better schools, technical schools, and get a technical background. There are many of the studios now that are taking in black people, some of them on quota basis, but whatever the reason, they're taking in black people. But you have to be prepared to do the work that's going to be there. It's a beautiful field. It allows you a great deal of freedom.
I imagine, like most fields in the New York situation, it's highly competitive, and those you really do have to know, you really do have to work. Again, I want to underline, I guess, in regard to, as I know you, that you are a terrific worker. That's one of the facets of your reputation, and I suspect that that's a very important facet.
Yes, you right. have to be motivated. I was motivated.
Yeah. Right.
I'd spent 25 years back there doing nothing.
Yes,
you have to be motivated. Yeah. And I think, though, that with this in mind, that there is nothing to stop anybody who has a desire to move forward in this industry.
Yeah.
Because it's just beginning. Television is just beginning. It hasn't gotten out of its pants yet. There has been really no great strides done for developing good drama specifically designed for television. We're still doing plays on television.
Yes.
We're doing play theater form on television, and the tube is not designed for that. Nobody has really come up with a way to do it, and that has to be done.
What do you think about the effort that was made in the Black America series for CBS? Do you think it was successful? Do you think it was? What are some of your ideas on that?
I think it was commendable of CBS. I think it didn't go far enough. I think they should do several others. We had a lot of different opinions about what was right for that series, and some of them I was able to get through it as the black producer on the show.
Which ones in particular? I saw most of the series. Which ones were you? What were some of your favorite ideas?
I worked on seven, on five of the seven programs, and we sat around in meetings and discussed what was right and what was wrong. I couldn't tear down now, John,
yes,
any of the things.
Yeah.
There were many things that they came up with a script and I read it and said, no, we can't do it this way because you're talking about things that just have no meaning, no relevancy to the black situation. But the things that did come out were, I helped to change the Bill Cosby speech so that it came out the way we have it now. The first draft that came through was not strong, not saying very much, but the one that came through was beautiful.
Yes.
Well, do you plan to produce any more documentaries in the future like that one?
I hope to produce many documentaries. I hope that that I will do most of them with black people. There is, of course, always the need for someone to pay the bill for things like
I
that.
I can imagine.
But I found myself working for no. I'm not concerned with the success syndrome where money is concerned. I'm involved. I involve myself at this stage of the game with things that mean something to me on a higher level. And if there's something that comes along that has no money in it, as this Mississippi venture I'm going into, I throw myself into it if it has meaning for me.
What is the Mississippi venture? Are you going to photograph down there?
I'm going to set up a class, really, to train black students, black people in the communications field. To teach them photography, teach them motion picture, film techniques, editing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. To set up a class that will continue after I leave, you see.
I see.
Hopefully to do three or four film with them, to have them do three or four film while I'm there.
Is this in connection with the school, or how
is... No, this is with a connection with an offshoot of the Poor People's Campaign.
Oh, I see.
Could you tell me something real quick about the theatrical workshop that you mentioned in the lecture?
Oh, the National Black Theater Workshop. It is the workshop of the future for black people. It is the most rewarding experience I think I've had in a number of years. I have spent a lot of time in theater and in television and doing commercials and other documentaries and industrial film, but this is the first time that I really have involved myself completely. I come out of every class exhausted, emotionally, physically, and mentally. This is only in New York City now, but we hope to spread it throughout the country, to spread our thinking about teaching black acting, an acting technique. And we hope that we'll be able to start workshops throughout the country. But it's just beginning now. Barbara Ann Teer is the director and founder of the group. She's an alumnus of the University of Illinois, I believe.
You told me, Wardell, that this theater work was one of the great experiences in your life, or is continuing to be, because it is helping you to look into yourself and therefore to open yourself.
That's true.
Right?
That's true.
Well, can you talk more about that? No, I mean, how you can open yourself?
Well, in...
I'd like to know myself. I mean, about me. If you did the white theater workshop, I'd also do the same thing for
right,
me.
Right, no.
Well, we all go through life with our own personal hang-ups, of course. But as we go through life and involve ourselves in things, we very often close ourselves in, to find ourselves in boxes, because this is the way we are. We forget about things that are important to us. We lose the heritage that is part of our background. And this theater workshop is investigating the things that we as black people had turned away from, the spirituality, for instance. And that's about the essence of it.
Well, do you think that there could ever be a beige theater workshop?
A beige theater workshop? Well, there is room for it.
This has been A Conversation with Wardell Gaynor, today's edition of Open End, a series of discussion programs dealing with current topics. With Mr. Gaynor this afternoon were Joseph Tankersley, junior in commerce at the University of Illinois, Elise Piquet, author, and John Schuller, head of painting in the College of Fine Arts at the University of Illinois in Urbana. Open End is produced by WILL, the radio service of the University of Illinois in Urbana.